Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRT-LP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime at kdrt.org/davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan, I'm your host. Thank you for tuning in today. It's 2025. We are deep in the digital age with artificial intelligence coming on hard as yet another potentially profound injection of technology into the human experience. This month, though, Davis will get its annual visit from an arts and satire group that's rooted in a different approach that uses a very analog method to get its point across. We're talking about the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which is celebrating its 66th season this year with Disruption, a new musical, staged for free in Bay Area parks and in Davis on Thursday, July 10th. It'll be indoors in Davis. Our summers are a little hot out here. Anyway, today we're talking with Michael Gene Sullivan, who wrote, directs, and acts in the play. He's joining us by Zoom during dress rehearsal week. And Michael, I know that's not an easy time to find a spare hour to do things like this. So thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Bill.
So the Mime Troupe is coming to Davis again this summer. It's come here lots of years. Why do you include Davis so faithfully on your circuit?
Well, I mean, one of the things that can happen with a company like the Mime Troupe, doing political theater and trying to get out there and change people's minds and stuff, is that even for us, being a very urban company, we don't want to get into this mindset of, oh, there's the city and then there's the hinterlands. We know that these parts in the Central Valley and all across the country are so important to the dynamic of what's going on in the United States. And sometimes the major media really focuses on big cities as places of innovation and where things happen, and places that are not big cities as like, oh, they're just victims. They're not in themselves innovative. They're not doing anything. They're just suffering, or they're just farmers, or things like that. And we want to go, no. We're all in one big community. We're just in different rooms in the community. It's important for us to understand the other rooms and what's going on and represent them.
Okay, so Davis is partly just to get you out of your own zone in San Francisco and see something different.
Well, but also to kind of show people that aren't in the Bay Area or what's going on here, we did a show years and years ago called Red State. I wrote the show and I set it in the imaginary town of Bluebird, Kansas. And so I wanted to write the show about this little town in Kansas and how national politics was impacting it. So I'm reading books and all this stuff, and people said, oh, you should have a Bay Area character who comes in and knows all of this stuff. And they're like helping the people in the town with understanding the wider world. And I was like, so extraordinarily condescending to have this thought. As a matter of fact, I made sure that the only character who was from the Bay Area was a bit of an idiot and was a condescending, I was like, no. And it's not something where you have, oh, well, there's this small town wisdom or something like that. It's just people. We're all struggling with the same overall issues in our country of racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, AI, losing jobs, losing factories, those grand issues, losing farm jobs, what's happening at the university. These are all things we're all dealing with, and we have to find that commonality so we can find our common enemy, profit.
So you probably know this already, but Davis is possibly the, no, not possibly, I think it is the most Bay Area town that you will find.
Outside of the Bay Area,
Yeah. But you also include places like Ukiah on your circuit, and that's not a college town.
No. And we used to play when we had more money from the state of California. We used to play the Central Valley much more. We would play Chico and go up to the foothills, and we'd go down to Fresno. We'd go to these different places again because those things that kind of knit the state together, art can knit the state together culturally in a way. And then it doesn't mean that everybody's the same, but it does mean that we can share certain ideals and ideas to whoever happens to show up.
So tell us a little bit about the troupe's history. I know it's a long history. It goes long back, long back.
I won't take that long.
But also, I found when I was getting ready for this interview, I was telling people I was going to be talking to you from the Mime Troupe. And people who don't know the Mime think, well, what, Marcel Marceau? How does that work? So explain to us how the Mime works, what it means in your context, and also how the troupe got started.
Troupe got started in 59, 1959. So we're a very old theater company. It started off as literally a silent mime class. R.G. Davis was teaching this class. And he started becoming more performance oriented and focusing on different types of theater, like commedia dell'arte, melodrama, all these different styles. And in those days, more people understood that the word mime doesn't mean silent mime. It's like if you go to England and you see a pantomime, you see a panto, and they're talking and singing and dressed like giant ducks or whatever. It's a pantomime. Mime is the exaggeration of everyday life in story and song. Silent mime is a type of mime. So if you go to see a Broadway musical, technically it's kind of a mime show because they're doing this big exaggerated thing with singing and dancing and talking and stuff. They just don't call it that. So the mime troupe, technically we are doing mime. It's just that most Americans don't know what the word means anymore
All
because
right.
Marcel Marceau did such a wonderful job with silent mime.
You write from contemporary events, right? In fact,
Yeah.
you've written or co-written 30 plays for the mime troupe
Yeah,
so
something
far.
like that. Yeah, at least.
And you take them from contemporary events. In fact, as we were setting up, you said that you were just finishing this current play. So tell us about Disruption. What headlines have you ripped your story idea from?
Oh, all of them. I mean, what people ask sometimes about writing a play, pretty much writing a play a year, and they go, "Oh, well, you must have been working on this for months and months." And I'm like, "No, I work on the actual script. It comes relatively quickly. It's a year of research. Of reading the news, watching the news, listening to podcasts, reading history books, going through all this to try to find a way to make this moment, to crystallize this moment, to bring it together in a way that the audience can go, we recognize our lives, we see ourselves in this, and answers some of the questions that they might have about the community and about the world. It's not easy. And it's really, and on a late year like this, when the news is really, a daily catastrophe almost. Every day is a blazing headline about some new part of our society being on fire, literally and figuratively. It was very difficult to try to find the thing. But what I realized in going through all that was disruption. That's what this is about. That word has gotten this weird positive spin, from innovators and Silicon Valley and people think, I'm going to disrupt this. No. At best, they're coming up with a slightly new version of an old thing. If you come up with a new tennis shoe, you didn't disrupt the market. It's just a new tennis shoe. Calm down. If you come up with, you're like, oh, we've got this app that's going to disrupt this. No, it's just an evolution at best, and normally a scam at worst. Whenever somebody just says they're disrupting something, it normally means they're cutting union jobs or they're ripping off investors.
Now that's in the current sense, but of course, if you go back to the counterculture, that literally was about disruption. It was about disruption of
Right.
established order. So is your point that the word's been sort of co-opted by
Yes,
technology?
very much
Okay.
so. It's like the word revolutionary. Revolutionary means to take those who are at the bottom and make them at the top, and those at the top at the bottom. It's a revolve, it's a revolution. But what we've got now are people who are already extraordinarily rich calling themselves revolutionaries. They're not revolutionaries, they're simply really rich people who want more money. Our language has gotten twisted around. And so, what I realized was that it wasn't these individual industries or technologies that were getting disrupted. What's being disrupted is our lives, our ethics, the idea that altruism is a problem, that caring for other people is really what's pulling us all down. It's very 1984 newspeak, this, what the word means, and then how things are being translated to a point where they mean the exact opposite.
And so your play addresses this, right? I've only read the synopsis that was provided with the press materials, so I don't know much about it, but it's all about tech trying to tame San Francisco. Is that a fair
Well, that's
summary?
part of it. There are really three stories. One is about an immigrant who came over here as a young child, a Filipino American man who grew up in Daly City, lives in San Francisco, works at a little coffee shop. And what he does is, whenever something, he's a very nice person. He's a traditional, empathetic, altruistic person. And if he sees his neighbor needs something, he helps them. If he sees that Meals on Wheels is cutting funding, he takes his own money to buy food for the people who need it. If somebody needs their new Medicare paperwork filled out, he will help them with that. He's that kind of person who, when he sees a crack in the system and people falling in it, he will help them. But he has a friend who's saying, by helping these people, aren't you papering over much deeper problems? Aren't you plastering over a crack in the wall that's really showing that the house is about to fall? Are you part of the problem by trying to help on this level? And I think that's a big question for a lot of people in society. Is it better to try to fix all the little things to help the person who's your neighbor, to help all of these people? But isn't that making the intolerable tolerable? So that's one story. And like I said, he's a child of immigrants. And so he has to be concerned about the change in society in general. Is he still accepted here? Why did his family come here? The second story is a police officer who's from the East Coast. And he thinks of California as, you know, California, weak and weird and granola and pecan water and whatever. And so his issue is that he came here because I play this part because I'm also in the show as a black gay cop. He couldn't really feel accepted on the East Coast. So now he moves out here. But with all of the stuff that's going on, he is being put in the awkward position of having to police communities that he would normally, you would think he would naturally support. And, you know, he's in a relationship with someone who's trying to point that out to him to say, yes, this is your job. And you may say you want to do all of these things. You may say you want to support freedom and the Constitution and civil rights and rights of free speech. But you are what you do. You're not what you say. You're not your best version of yourself. You are what you do. And so he has to struggle with this contradiction that he's been put in. This isn't why he became a cop, to help ICE, basically. And then the third story is the one about technology. But it's not just about technology, it's about the idea that if you're really good in business, somehow really good at raising money, in Silicon Valley, that means you'd be really good at running a city. And those are two completely different things. And we're dealing with this fetishization to a large extent of people who can raise money in Silicon Valley. Oh, they made an app. You don't even have the app. Nobody has the app, but they raised $1 billion for this app. That means they'll know how to infuse energy into downtown San Francisco. No, they won't. It's a different thing. And you cannot make government, which is essentially and fundamentally a service organization, into a for-profit organization. It is two different mentalities. They don't overlap. Corporatization is fundamentally antithetical to democracy. We have now a president who wants, people say, oh, Trump wants to be a dictator. I don't think so. He wants to be CEO,
He
you
wants to
know,
be a
and
strong
that's
CEO, I suppose
a
he'd say.
strong CEO who doesn't have to answer to his board and just what he says goes. And it's all about, is this profitable? And that's a different thing. And I think it's the purest example of the corporatization of a government. And we have to see it that way. The problem is the corporatization. And even if Trump goes, the idea that we need to make government more like a business is the problem, because it can't be.
Do a quick station ID. This is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California, kdrt.org/Davisville. We are talking with Michael Gene Sullivan, who has written, directs, and acts in the San Francisco Mime Troupe's current play, Disruption, a new musical, which they are bringing to Davis for performance. They come to Davis pretty much every summer. All right, a live performance has the power of a human connection, but you'd almost certainly get much larger audiences in a digital format. So I'm wondering if your purpose is not so much to maximize the size of your audience by choosing this format, I mean, but if your purpose is something else.
We always want to challenge our audience. That's one of the things that people will say, oh, you do political theater, you're just preaching to the choir. And it's like, well, first of all, sometimes the choir needs a little preaching, but also all theater is done for the people who show up. You know, you can't break into people's houses and do a show for them and make them watch it. We tried that, and it's hard to get funding for that. What you have to do is you do the best show you can. When people ask, well, what's it like to see a mime troupe show? And I say, we do musical political theater. So what we do is it's just like seeing a Broadway show, only it's much smaller and it has a point. We want to make sure that we're telling the audience something, challenging them in a way to see a working class perspective, which you can't get from television, for instance. You can't get it because television is going to go through so many filters of corporatization that they may talk, they may, you make, oh, well, so-and-so's saying something that negative about this politician or that politician and stuff, but none of them are saying anything about bad about corporations.
Well, okay,
You
I
know,
don't,
the
but I,
idea of corporations.
yeah, I get, but my point though is, I mean, if you did your own YouTube channel, for example,
Oh, I have a YouTube channel.
okay, well, there you go. I mean, my point is people can watch that when they want, and that's kind of where things have evolved to. But you, it's, you know, you're making, the troupe is making a deliberate choice to do this live in person to an audience that shows up in person. It reminds me a little, we have a film critic in town, for example, who says he'd much rather see a movie in a theater with other people. The shared experience is what he's after. And so there's a different impact there.
Well, yes, but when you have live theater, I mean, the Mime Troupe would love to be able to do both. We just have not been able to create the bandwidth for us to be able to have the troupe to have an active YouTube channel, also because we have union performers. I'm in SAG-AFTRA and in Equity. So in order to do that, it would take a lot of money for us to be able to invest in that. Sometimes we have been able to stream some of our shows so that people around the country can see them. Places that we used to tour to. We used to go to o Ohio every year and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, and we haven't been able to afford that. So we still stream our shows every year. This year, we will not be able to stream our show for the first time in the last few years because we don't have enough money to do our full summer. We're doing a shortened summer. So we wanted to make sure to get Davis in there. We're doing a shortened summer, which means if we were to film the show and stream it, it would be after the show closed. In which case it would cost us another $10,000 to do, and we don't have the money. So unfortunately, we can't stream this year, but we would like to reach both. But you're right in that seeing the live performance, what you get, especially with a show that's trying to tell you something different, is you get to look around at an audience and go, I'm not crazy. I'm not the nut my family at Thanksgiving thinks I am when I'm bringing up, revolution, because I can look around and see all of these other people who have the same questions and have come to the same place for this analysis. Every theater audience is a self-selecting community. And you always want that community to grow. You always want people who know to bring more people so that you can have discussions afterwards. It's not merely an entertainment. It is a community watching an analysis and hopefully being entertained by it.
I do wonder about the audience that you attract. We're in a very polarized age, and I would imagine, well, okay, if one is the target of your satire, and in this case, you know, a tech bro or someone who voted for Trump, if they watched your show, would they just simply feel caricatured and accused, and in which case they're likely not to feel challenged, but just sort of isolated and stop listening?
Well, that's a challenge for me as a writer, is to make sure, because I'm very much against the pie throwing satire of here's my enemy, I sit him up, create a straw man, make fun of him, set fire to him. The reason that I included, say, the conservative, not conservative, but a regular working class cop. And when I was describing the character to someone, they were like, oh, I don't want this guy to be a hero. And I said, well, he's not a hero, but he's not a villain either. He's totally understandable where he grew up, how the town that he grew up in was a union town. But when NAFTA passed, people blamed the Democrats for that. And so, when the factory shuts down and leaves, a lot of people went from being Democrats to Republicans because they felt betrayed by Clinton and the Democrats. That's a real thing. And those people should be understood that what they went through, their lives were ruined. And from their perspective, by the Democrats.
So, am I going too far to say that if someone were a conservative voter and then they saw your show, that they would feel at least heard or understood or something? Obviously, you're not going to agree with them, or at least I don't think you would. But you know, would they not feel excluded, I guess, is my point, by your satire?
I don't know. I mean, it really depends on the person. Like, if a real racist shows up, they're gonna feel excluded. If a Nazi shows up, they're gonna kind of go, oh, this isn't for me. But if they are just regular working class people looking for answers and not biased, because the bias is what, somebody hates immigrants and they see a show that has to do with immigrants, I'm not sure why they're there. But if they're saying, well, this is an issue that I'm dealing with and I see the country is dealing with, and I don't get this. and I don't see it from the other side, coming to see any show. It doesn't matter if it's like, as a man, I've seen one woman shows, you know, and I was not represented on the stage, but it gave me an opportunity to see something from someone who doesn't have exactly my experience.
Sure. Well, and the larger point perhaps is, I mean, there's lots of points of view in the world, and going to see your show is like reading a certain type of a magazine. Would have been at one point. Magazines aren't so prevalent now.
Back when those, yeah.
But I mean, if you read widely, in other words, you'll get a variety of points of view. And I think I'm getting your sense that, you know, you're gonna people will get a point of view from you, but you don't want them to just feel, as you say, pie in the face, like, oh, look, here's the dopey person who doesn't think like we do. And, you know, I suppose on the other side, you'd have people who might agree with the satire, agree with everything you're saying, but they might think, yeah, well, you said this earlier rather well, that's the choir. But your point is you want to preach to the choir sometimes too. What is it you want them to know? If they fundamentally agree with what you're saying, what else do you want them to know?
Well, the people who there are people who every year defining the space where these are people who may fundamentally agree, they think, with the mime troupe. But like our last year's show, American Dreams, which was very well reviewed, very popular show, but there were long-term mime troupe members who disagreed with part of the show. They just were like, how can you say this if you would just cut this part out? And I always have to tell the cast after the show, direct them to, if I'm there, direct those people to me and I will tell them why we made this choice. You know, having people who were so passionate about the being in favor of the protests and the anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s and the anti-apartheid movement of the 80s. But then we're like, we got to stop these protesters who are saying free Palestine. That's not a free speech issue. We got to shut down these students. They should. And it's like, you were those students back in the 80s. If it's free speech, then it's free speech for them and for you. But I had a lot of people who had been those kinds of protesters who didn't like the fact that I portrayed those protesters on stage last year and talked about that free speech. So challenging different people, you know, you can't challenge everybody all the time because then you're just being a contrarian and you're just kind of being a jerk. You want to stay true to what you believe and challenge enough people to say, yes. And that's why they come. Audiences come to see a mime troupe show to be entertained. They want to hear the music. They want to hear, you know, we've got Daniel Savio write beautiful music for the shows. They want to see all of that, but they also want to see a slightly different point of view than they have and maybe get some information they didn't already have.
We have just a few minutes left. One of the questions I had was what drew you to this line of work? But after listening to you in this interview, you're very animated and very expressive. And it seems to me I can see why you were drawn to theater and even maybe particularly this one. But you've been with the troupe a long time. What drew you to it? Why this as opposed to Broadway or musicals or something else?
I mean, I work at other theater companies. I do shows all over. I've got plays, other plays that I've written, non-mime troupe shows. They're always political that have run around the world. I'm published in different languages, but the mime troupe was the original company that I saw when my father took me to see a mime troupe show when I was in my teens. And I was a history major. I was going to teach history. That's what I wanted to do. And he took me to see this theater company. At that point, I was not thinking about being an actor at all. And they were doing comedy and music, a big physical comedy, like being in a cartoon. And at the same time, what they were talking about was important. And my parents, they took me and my sisters to every protest imaginable when I was a kid, every anti-war, every free speech. They donated money to the Black Panthers. My parents moved to San Francisco because they believed this is where the revolution was going to start and they wanted to be at the epicenter. My mother worked for Bobby Kennedy and was unfortunately there when he was assassinated. You know, I grew up in a very political family. And so having the opportunity to take all of that politics, all of the cartoons I watched as a child, and all the comedy I listened to, and all the history that I had learned, and put it into, and really having the epiphany of seeing the mime troupe and going, this is what I can do. I want to work with this company. So I've done a lot of Shakespeare. I've done, you know, work at ACT and San Francisco Playhouse and do theater all over. But my goal was always to get to the mime troupe. And once I got here, and I started writing and directing. I still, in the off season, I still work other places, but this is my inspirational artistic home. And also my wife, who I've gone to, Melina Brown, who's been in a lot of mime troupe shows and direct a lot of shows. Yeah, she joined the company a few years after I did. So this has also given us a opportunity. People are always confused. They're like, you work with your wife all the time. You see her at home and you see her at work. And it's like, if I didn't love her, that would be weird, but I want to be with her all I can. So it's worked out really well, but it does give me a place and a chance to say stuff. The place when I can't say stuff, the mind trip, like I said, I've got a YouTube channel where I just talk about politics, and then I've got plays that run other places.
You alluded to the financial problems. You're a nonprofit. You guys aren't getting the money that you did before for the grants and all that. Now, your shows are free, but you ask for donations. How are you guys doing financially? Is there going to be a 67th
67.
year? Yeah.
Well, hopefully it's tough because the mind trip has always struggled with financially because we don't take corporate sponsorships. And most theater companies, as our culture has become more and more corporatized, there's an expectation, really. We've had to fire people because we'd hire them to come in as fundraisers. And the first thing they'd say is, I'm going to Bank of America to ask for money. I'm going to Wells Fargo to ask for money. And we're like, no, you have to be much more imaginative than that because we cannot critique, honestly critique any idea of capitalism or corporatism if we're taking their money. And people say, oh, you're using their money against them. Yes, but what happens is you start censoring yourself. You want to write a play that's about some bank bailout, but you go, ooh, if we do that, then maybe Wells Fargo won't give us, they give us 50,000 a year, and maybe they won't do that. So maybe we'll back off of that. And as you start to self-censor, you become less and less important. And so we don't take corporate sponsorships. We used to rely on NEA grants and money from the city of San Francisco, money from the state of California, foundations and major donors, and mainly just everyday folk. We're much more like the Sanders campaign or AOC in that
Bernie Sanders, yeah. Bernie
relying
Sanders for
on,
the, yeah, sorry.
oh, for the folks who could be Colonel Sanders, right? Colonel Bernie Sanders. That the idea of we ask for money after the show, and because the show is free to see, but it is not free to do. That's the other thing. Sometimes people go, oh, the mind trip, you're doing this for fun. No, this is our job. And we're union workers, and we pay ourselves. We're run by the workers, our company, rather than having like an artistic director who runs things. The artistic director is a collective of actors, designers, musicians. And we're not on full-time salary. We're only paid when we're working for the mime troupe. But it still costs hundreds of thousands of dollars for us to do a show. This year, with the NEA changing to every show has to be what they deem patriotic, and that cuts down on money. The state of California is having budgetary problems. We did get money from the city of San Francisco, which was nice. But our costs, we have to pay to be in the parks. When we're doing free shows and we're in a public park, we have to pay for the park. Those rates go up and up. Every porta potty that's out there is $1,000. Everything costs.
So we're right near the end, but it sounds like you think you'll be able to continue.
I certainly hope so. I
All
mean,
right.
we've got this summer is shorter, and we have our Christmas show, Red Carol, which we're raising funds for now, and then hopefully we'll be back next year.
Okay, and then quickly, if people want to find out about tickets, times, places like that, this is all on your website, right?
It is SFMT, San Francisco Mime Troupe.org. And they can go on there and they'll see a complete schedule of all the places we're playing, snippets from the show, a history of the company, things that we're planning in the future, ways they can help us and study with us or support us.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Michael Gene Sullivan of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Michael, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Bill.
This is Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan, KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California, KDRT.org online. Thank you for listening.